Chapter 20. The day of my discharge from the army at Camp Kilmer, I met Tom Clifford at the Breffni Bar on 3rd Avenue in Manhattan. We had corned beef and cabbage, slathered with mustard and beer galore to cool our mouths. Tom had found an Irish bed and breakfast place in the South Bronx, Logan's boarding house. And once I dropped off my duffel bag there, we could come back down and see Emma after work in her apartment at East 54th Street. Mr. Logan seemed to be an old man, with a bald head and a meaty red face. He might have been old, but he had a young wife, Nora from Kilkenny, and a baby a few months old. He told me he was high up in the Ancient Order of Hibernians and the Knights of Columbus, and I should make no mistake about where he stood on religion and morality in general, that none of his 12 boarders could expect the Sunday morning breakfast unless they could show they'd attended Mass and, if at all possible, Holy Communion. For those who attended Communion and had at least 2 witnesses to prove it, there would be sausages with the breakfast. Of course every boarder had 2 other boarders to testify he went to Communion. There was testifying right and left, and Mr. Logan was so upset over what he had to pay out in sausages, he disguised himself in Nora's hat and coat and shuffled up to the middle of the church to discover not only that the boarders hadn't gone to Communion, but that Ned Guinan and Kevin Hayes were the only ones to go to Mass at all. The rest were over on Willis Avenue slipping in the back door of a bar for an illegal drink before noon opening time, and when they came streeling back for the breakfast, reeking, Mr. Logan wanted to smell their breath. They told him, feck off, this was a free country, and if they had to get their breath smelled for the sake of a sausage, they'd stay content with the watery eggs and milk, the stale bread and watery tea. Also, there was to be no swearing or any kind of blackguarding in Mr. Logan's house, or we'd be asked to desist and depart. He would not allow his wife and child, Matthew, to be exposed to any kind of disgraceful behavior from the 12 young Irish boarders. Our beds might be in the basement, but he would always know about disgraceful behavior. No, indeed it takes years to build up a boarding house business, and he was not going to let 12 laborers from the old country tear it down. Bad enough that Negroes were moving in right and left and destroying a neighborhood, people with no morality, no jobs, and no fathers for their children running the streets like savages. The weekly rate was $18 for bed and breakfast, and if I wanted dinner, that would be an extra dollar a day. There were 8 beds for 12 boarders, and that was because everyone worked different shifts on the docks and various warehouses. And what was the use of having extra beds cluttering up the 2 rooms in the basement? The only time all the beds were filled was Saturday night, and then you had to bunk in with someone else. Didn't matter, because Saturday night was the night to get drunk up on St. Nicholas Avenue, and you wouldn't care if you slept with man, woman, or sheep. There was one bathroom for all of us, bring your own soap, and 2 long narrow towels that used to be white. Each towel had a black line to separate the top from the bottom, and that was how you were supposed to use them. There was a handwritten sign on the wall telling you the top was for anything above your navel, the bottom for anything below. Signed, J. Logan, proprietor. The towels were changed every 2 weeks, that there were always fights between the boarders who were careful about the rules and the ones who might have had a drink. Chris Wayne from Listdoonvarna was the oldest boarder, 42, working in construction and saving to bring over his girlfriend, 23, so that they could get married and have children, while he still had a tittle of power in himself. The boarders called him Duke because of his last name and because of the silliness in it. He didn't drink or smoke, went to Mass and Communion every Sunday, and avoided the rest of us. He had tufts of gray in his curly black hair, and he was gaunt from piety and frugality. He had his own towel, soap, and 2 sheets he carried around in a bag for fear we might use them. Every night he knelt by his bed and said the entire rosary. He was the only one who'd secured a bed of his own, since no one, drunk or sober, would climb in with him or use the bed in his absence because of the odor of sanctity around it. He worked from 8 to 5 every workday and ate dinner with the Logans every night. They loved him for that because it brought in an extra $7 a week. And they loved him even more for the small amounts he put into his scrawny frame. They didn't love him later when he started coughing and spitting and there were specks of blood in his handkerchief. They told him they had a child to think of and he'd better find another place. He told Mr. Logan he was a son of a bitch and a pathetic bastard that he felt sorry for. If he thought he was really the father of that child, Mr. Logan should look around at his borders, and if he wasn't completely blind, he'd detect a marked resemblance to the child on the face of one of the borders. Mr. Logan struggled out of his armchair, gasping that if he didn't have the bad heart, he'd kill Chris Wayne on the spot. He tried to rush at the Duke, but his heart wouldn't let him, and he had to listen to Nora from Kilkenny screeching at him, begging him to stop or she'd be a widow with an orphan child. The Duke laughed till he gasped at Nora, "Don't worry, that child will always have a father. Sure isn't he in this room?" He coughed his way out of the room and down the stairs to the basement, and no one ever saw him again. It was hard to live there after that. Mr. Logan was suspicious of everyone, and you could hear him roaring at Nora from Kilkenny at all hours. He took away one of the towels and saved money by buying all bread at the bakery and serving powdered milk and eggs for breakfast. He wanted to make us all go to confession so that he could watch our faces and know if what the Duke said was true. We refused. There were only 4 boarders long enough in the house to be suspects, and Peter McNamee, the longest one there, told Mr. Logan to his face that fooling around with Nora from Kilkenny was the last thing he'd ever think of. She was such a bag of bones from running the house, you could hear her rattle and clank coming up the stairs. Mr. Logan gasped in his armchair and told Peter, "That hurt me, Peter, that you'd say my wife clanks, and you're the finest boarder we ever had, even if we were fooled a long time by the false piety of the fellow that just left, thank God. I'm sorry to hurt you, Mr. Logan, but Nora from Kilkenny is not by any means a morsel. No one here would give her a second look on a dance floor." Mr. Logan looked around the room at us. "Is that right, lads? Is that right?" "'Tis, Mr. Logan." "You sure of that, Peter?" "I am, Mr. Logan." "Thank God for that, Peter." The boarders earn good money on the docks and in the warehouses. Tom works at port warehouses, loading and unloading trucks. And if he works extra hours, he goes on time and a half, or double time, so that his pay is well over $100 a week. Peter McNamee works at Merchants Refrigerating Company, unloading and storing the meat from the freezer trucks from Chicago. The Logans like him for the slabs of beef or pork he hauls home every Friday night, drunk or sober, and that meat takes the place of the $18. We never see this meat, and some boarders swear Mr. Logan sells it to a butcher shop on Willis Avenue. All the boarders drink, even though they say they want to save money and go back to Ireland for the peace and quiet that's in it. Only Tom says he'll never go back, that Ireland is a miserable bog of a place, and they take that as a personal insult and offer to settle it if he'll step outside. Tom laughs. He knows what he wants. And it's not a life of fighting and drinking and mourning about Ireland and sharing towels and flop houses like this. The only one who agrees with Tom is Ned Guinan, and it doesn't matter with him because he has the consumption like the Duke, and he's not long for this world. He's saving enough money so that he can go home to Kildare and die in the house he was born in. He has dreams of Kildare, where he's leaning on a fence at the Curragh watching the horses training in the morning, trotting through the mist that clouds the track till the sun breaks through and turns the whole world green. When he talks like this, his eyes glisten, and there's a slight pink flush on his cheeks, and he smiles in such a way, you'd like to go over and hold him a minute, though that's the kind of thing they might frown on in an Irish boarding house. It's remarkable that Mr. Logan allows him to stay. But Ned is so delicate, Mr. Logan treats him like a son and forgets the baby who might be threatened by coughs, spits, and flecks of blood. It's remarkable the way they keep him on the payroll at the Baker and Williams warehouse, where they have him in the office answering the phone because he's so weak he can't lift a feather. When he's not answering the phone, he studies French so that he can talk to St. Therese, the little flower, when he goes to heaven. Mr. Logan tells him very gently, he might be on the wrong track in this matter, that Latin is the language you need in heaven, and that leads to a long discussion among the boarders as to what language our Lord spoke, Peter McNamee declaring for a fact it was Hebrew. Mr. Logan says, you might be right there, Peter, because he doesn't want to contradict the man who brings the Sunday meat home on a Friday night. Tom Clifford laughs that we should all brush up on our Irish in case we run into St. Patrick or St. Bridget, and everyone glares at him, everyone but Ned Guinan, who smiles at everything, because it doesn't matter one way or the other when you're dreaming of the horses in Kildare. Peter McNamee says it's a wonder a single one of us is alive with all the things against us in this world, the weather in Ireland, the TB, the English, the De Valera government, the one Holy Roman Catholic and Apostolic Church, and now the way we have to break our arses to make a few dollars on the docks and the warehouses. Mr. Logan begs him to mind his language in the presence of Nora from Kilkenny, and Peter says he's sorry. He gets carried away. Tom tells me of a job unloading trucks at port warehouses. Emma says no, I should work in an office where I can use my brains. Tom says warehouse jobs are better than office jobs that pay less and make you wear a suit and tie and have you sitting so much you get an arse on you the size of a cathedral door. I'd like to work in an office, but the warehouse pays $75 a week, and that's more than I ever dreamed of after my $35 a week at the Biltmore Hotel. Emma says that's fine, as long as I save something and get an education. She talks like that because everyone in her family went to school. She doesn't want me lifting and hauling till I'm a broken old man at the age of 35. She knows from the way Tom and I talk about the boarders that there's drinking and all kinds of blackguarding, and she wouldn't like me to be spending my time in bars when I could be making something of myself. Emma has a clear head because she doesn't drink or smoke, and the only meat she eats is an occasional morsel of chicken for her blood. She goes to a business school at Rockefeller Center so that she can earn a living and make something of herself in America. I know her clear head is good for me, but I want that warehouse money, and I promise her and myself I'll go to school someday. Mr. Campbell Grohl, who owns port warehouses, isn't too sure if he wants to hire me, that I might be too scrawny. Then he looks at Tom Clifford, who's smaller and scrawnier and the best worker on the platform, and if I'm half as strong and fast, I have the job. The platform boss is Eddie Lynch, a fat man from Brooklyn. When he talks to me or Tom, he laughs and puts on a Barry Fitzgerald accent, which I don't think is a bit funny, though I have to smile because he's the boss and I want the $75 every Friday. At noon, we sit on the platform with our lunches from the diner on the corner, long liverwurst and onion sandwiches dripping with mustard, and Rheingold beer so cold it gives me a pain on my forehead. The Irish talk about the drinking they did last night, and they laugh over their great sufferings in the morning. Italians eat the food they brought from home, and don't know how we can eat that liverwurst shit. The Irish are offended and want to fight, except that Eddie Lynch says anyone in a fight on this platform can go looking for a job. There's one black man, Horace, and he sits away from the rest of us. He smiles once in a while and says nothing, because that's the way it is. When we finish at 5, someone will say, okay, let's go for a beer, one beer, just one. We all laugh at the idea of one beer. We drink at bars with longshoremen from the piers, who are always fighting over whether their union, the ILA, should join the AFL or the CIO. And when they're not fighting about that, they're fighting about unfair hiring practices. Hiring bosses and gang foremen go to different bars farther into Manhattan for fear they might have trouble along the waterfront. There are nights when I stay out so late and I'm so confused with the drink, there's no sense going back to the Bronx at all. It's just as easy to sleep on the platform where the bums keep fires going and great drums on the street. Till Eddie Lynch comes along with his Barry Fitzgerald accent and tells us, off your arse and on your feet. Even when I'm hungover, I want to tell him arse is pronounced with a flat A, but he's from Brooklyn, and he's the boss, and he'll say arse forever. Sometimes there's night work on the piers unloading ships, and if there aren't enough longshoremen with ILA cards, they'll hire warehousemen like myself with Teamster cards. You have to be careful you're not taking jobs from longshoremen, because they think nothing of sinking a bailing hook in your skull and pushing you down between ship and dock on the chance you'll be crushed beyond recognition. They make better money in the docks than we do in the warehouses, but the work is unsteady, and they have to fight for it every day. I carry my own hook from the warehouse, but I've never learned to use it for anything but lifting. After 3 weeks at the warehouse and all the liverwurst and beer, I'm scrawnier than ever. Eddie Lynch says in his Brooklyn Brogue, "Faith and begorra, I could slip you and Clifford through the arse of a sparrow, two of yous." With the nights of drinking and working on the piers, my eyes are flaring up again. They're worse when I have to handle sacks of hot Cuban peppers from United Fruit ships. Sometimes the only thing that would give me relief is beer. And Eddie Lynch says, "Jesus Christ, the kid is so desperate for the beer, he's pouring it through his eyes." The warehouse money is good, and I should be content. Except there's nothing in my head but confusion and darkness. The Third Avenue L is packed every morning with people in suits and dresses, fresh and clean and happy in themselves. If they're not reading newspapers, they're talking. And I hear them describing their vacation plans or bragging about how well their children are doing in school or college. I know they'll work every day till they're old and silver-haired, and they'll be content with their children and grandchildren. And I wonder if I'll ever live like that. In June, the papers are filled with stories about university commencement exercises and pictures of happy graduates and their families. I try to look at the pictures, but the train rocks and jolts and I'm thrown against passengers who give me superior looks because of my work clothes. I want to announce that this is only temporary, that one day I'll be going to school and wearing a suit like them. Chapter 21. I wish I could be stronger at the warehouse and say no when someone laughs about going for a beer, one beer, just one. I should say no, especially when I'm supposed to meet Emma to go to a movie or eat a piece of chicken. Sometimes after hours of drinking I call her and tell her I had to work overtime, but she knows better. And the more I lie, the colder her voice, and there's no use calling and lying anymore. Then deep into the summer, Tom tells me Emma is going with someone else. She's engaged, she's wearing a big ring from her fiancé, an insurance man from the Bronx. She won't talk to me on the phone, and when I knock on her door, she won't let me in. I beg her for a minute so that I can tell her how I'm a changed man, how I'm going to mend my ways and lead a decent life. No more stuffing myself with liverwurst sandwiches, no more guzzling beer till I can hardly stand. She won't let me in. She's engaged, and there's a glint of diamond on her hand that sends me into such a wildness I want to pound the wall, tear out my hair, throw myself on the floor at her feet. I don't want to stumble away from her to Logan's boarding house, and the one towel, and the warehouses, and the docks, and the drinking till all hours while the rest of the world, Emma and her insurance man included, lead clean lives with towels galore, all happy on graduation day and smiling with their perfect American teeth brushed after every meal. I want her to take me in so that we can talk about the days before us when I'll have a suit and an office job and we'll have our own apartment and I'll be safe from the world and all temptation. She won't let me in. She has to go now. She has to see someone. And I know it's the insurance man. Is he inside? She says no, but I know he is, and I yell that I want to see him. Trot the bugger out and I'll deal with him. I'll lay him out. Then she shuts the door in my face, and I'm so shocked my eyes dry up, and all the heat leaves my body. I'm so shocked I wonder if my life is a series of doors closed in my face. So shocked I don't even want to go to the Breffni bar for a beer. People are passing me on the streets, and cars are honking, but I feel so cold and alone I could be in a prison cell. I sit on the 3rd Avenue L to the Bronx and think of Emma and her insurance man. How they're having a cup of tea and laughing at the way I disgrace myself. How clean and wholesome they are, the two of them, not drinking, not smoking, waving away the chicken. I know that's the way it is around the country. People sitting in the living room, smiling, secure, resisting temptation, growing old together because they're able to say, "No, thank you. I don't want a beer, not one." I know Emma is acting like this because of my behavior. And I know I'm the one she wants, not this man who's probably sipping tea, boring her to distraction with insurance stories. Still, she might like me again and take me back if I give up the warehouse, the docks, the liverwurst, the beer, and get a decent job. There's still a chance for me since Tom told me they won't be getting married till next year. And if I improve myself starting tomorrow, she'll surely take me back, although I don't like thinking of him sitting for months on the couch kissing her and running his paws all over her shoulder blades. Of course he's an Irish-American Catholic. That's what Tom told me. And of course he'll respect her purity till the wedding night, this insurance man. But I know Irish-American Catholics have filthy minds. They all have the dirty dreams I have myself, especially insurance men. I know Emma's man is thinking of the things they'll be doing on their wedding night, though he'll have to confess his dirty thoughts to the priest before he gets married. It's a good thing I'm not getting married myself, because I'd have to confess to the things I did with women all over Bavaria and across the border to Austria itself, and sometimes even Switzerland. There's an employment agency advertisement in the paper offering office job, steady, secure, well-paid, 6-week paid training session, suit and tie required, preference given veterans. The application form wants to know where I graduated from high school and when, and that forces me to lie. Christian Brothers Secondary School, Limerick, Ireland, June 1947. The agency man tells me the name of the company offering employment, Blue Cross. "Sir, what kind of company is that?" "Insurance." But what?" "Oh, it's all right, sir." It's all right because I realize if I'm hired by this insurance company, I might move up in the world and Emma will take me back. All she has to do is choose between two insurance men, even if the other one has already given her a diamond ring. Before I can even talk to her again, I have to finish my 6-week training course at the Blue Cross. The offices are on 4th Avenue in a building with an entrance like the door of a cathedral. There are 7 men in the training session, all high school graduates, one so badly wounded from the Korean War, his mouth has moved around to the side of his head, and he dribbles on his shoulder. It takes days to understand what he's trying to say, that he wants to work for Blue Cross so that he can help veterans like himself who were wounded and have no one. Then a few days into the course, he discovers he's in the wrong place, that it was the Red Cross he wanted all along, and he curses the instructor for not telling him before. We're glad to see him go, even after the way he suffered for America, but it's hard to be sitting all day with a man whose mouth is on the side of his head. The instructor is Mr. Puglio, and the first thing he tells us is that he's studying for his master's degree in business at NYU, and second, all the information we wrote on our application will be carefully checked, so if anyone claims he went to college and didn't, correct it now or else. The one thing Blue Cross won't tolerate is a lie. The boarders at Logan's laugh every morning when I put on my suit, shirt, tie. They laugh even harder when they hear what my pay is, $47 a week rising to 50 when I finish the training session. There are only 8 boarders left. Ned Guinan went home to Kildare to look at horses and die. And 2 others married waitresses from Schraff's, who are famous for saving up to go home and buy the old family farm. The tall Mark Toppenbottom is still there, but no one uses it after Peter McNamee caused a sensation by going out and buying a tall of his own. He says he was weary of looking at grown men dripping after their showers, walking around and shaking themselves dry like old dogs, men who would squander half their wages on whiskey, but couldn't see their way to buying a towel. He says it was the last straw one Saturday when five boarders sat around on their beds drinking duty-free Irish whiskey from Shannon Airport, talking and singing along with an Irish radio program, putting themselves in the mood for a dance in Manhattan that night. After they took showers, the towel was useless, and instead of walking around to shake themselves dry, they began to dance jigs and reels to the music on the radio. They were having a grand time, except that Nora from Kilkenny came to replace toilet paper and walked in without knocking, and when she saw what she saw, she screamed like a banshee and ran up the stairs hysterical to Mr. Logan, who came down to find the dancers rolling around naked and laughing and not giving a fiddler's fart about Mr. Logan and his yelling that they were a disgrace to the Irish nation and Mother Church, and he had a good mind to throw the lot of them into the street in their pelt, and what kind of mothers did they have at all? He went back upstairs mumbling because he'd never evict five boarders paying $18 each a week. When Peter brought his own towel home, everyone was astonished and tried to borrow it, but he told them bugger off and hid it in various places, though hiding it was a problem because the towel to dry needs to be hung up and will only grow damp and musty if folded and hidden under the mattress or the bathtub itself. It made Peter bitter that he couldn't hang his towel to dry till Nora from Kilkenny told him she'd take it upstairs and watch over it while it dried. She and Mr. Logan were that grateful for the meat he never failed to deliver every Friday night. That was a nice solution till Mr. Logan became agitated every time Peter went up for his dry towel and chatted a few minutes with Nora from Kilkenny. Mr. Logan would stare at his baby boy Matthew, then at Peter, and back again at the baby, and his frown would grow so severe his eyebrows met. He could stand it no longer and called up the stairs. "Does it take all day, Peter, to get your dry towel? Nora has work to do in this house." Peter would come down the stairs. "Ah, sorry, Mr. Logan, very sorry." But that doesn't satisfy Mr. Logan, who's staring at little Matthew again and back at Peter. "I have something to tell you, Peter. We won't be needing your meat anymore, and you'll have to find a way to keep your towel dry yourself. Nora has enough to do without standing guard over your towel while it dries." That night there is screaming and yelling in the Logan room, and next morning Mr. Logan pins a note to Peter's towel, telling him he'll have to leave, that he's caused too much damage to the Logan family, the way he took advantage of their good nature in the matter of drying the towel. Peter doesn't mind. He's moving out to Long Island to his cousin's house. We'll all miss him, the way he opened up the world of towels to us, and now we all have them. They're hanging everywhere. And everyone is honorable about not using other men's towels, because they never dry anyway in the dampness of the basement bedroom. Chapter 22. It's easier traveling on the train every morning in my suit and tie, and the New York Times held up so the world would see I'm not the kind of yob that reads comics in the Daily News or the Mirror. People will see that this is a man in a suit that can handle big words on his way to an important job in an insurance office. I might be wearing a suit and reading the Times and getting admiring looks, but I still can't help committing my daily deadly sin, envy. I see the college students with the covers on their books, Columbia, Fordham, NYU, CCNY, and I feel empty thinking I'll never be one of them. I'd like to go to one of the bookshops and buy college book covers I could flaunt on the train, except I know I'd be found out and laughed at. Mr. Puglia teaches us the different health insurance policies offered by Blue Cross, family, individual, company, widows, orphans, veterans, cripples. When he teaches, he becomes excited and tells us it's a wonderful thing to sleep at night knowing people have nothing to worry about if they get sick, as long as they have Blue Cross. We sit in a small room where the air is thick with cigarette smoke for lack of a window, and it's hard to stay awake on a summer's afternoon with Mr. Puglia getting worked up over premiums. Every Friday he gives us a test, and it's a misery on Monday, when he praises the higher scorers and frowns at the low scorers like me. My scores are low because I don't care about insurance, and I wonder if Emma is in her right mind getting engaged to an insurance man. Why, she could be with the man who went from training German shepherds to typing the fastest morning reports in the European command. I feel like calling her up and telling her now that I'm inside the insurance business is driving me mad. And is she happy she did this to me? I could still be working at port warehouses enjoying my liverwurst and beer if she hadn't broken my heart entirely. I'd like to call her, but I'm afraid she'll be cold, and that will drive me to the Breffni bar for relief. Tom is at the Breffni, and he says the best thing is to let the wound heal, have a drink. Now, where did you get that awful suit? It's bad enough to be suffering over the Blue Cross and Emma without having your suit sneered at, and when I tell Tom fuck off, he laughs and tells me I live. He's moving out of the boarding house himself to a small apartment in Woodside, Queens, and if I'd like to share, the cost is $10 a week. Cook our own food. Once again, I feel like calling Emma and telling her about my big job at Blue Cross and the apartment I'm getting in Queens, but her face is fading in my memory, and there's another place in my mind that tells me I'm glad to be single in New York. If Emma doesn't want me, what's the use of being in the insurance business, where I'm suffocated every day in an airless room with Mr. Puglia becoming hostile whenever I doze off? It's hard to sit there when he tells us that the first duty of a married man is to train his wife to be a widow, and I daydream about Mrs. Puglia getting the widow lecture. Does Mr. Puglia give her the lecture at the dinner table or sitting up in the bed? On top of everything, my appetite is gone from sitting all day in my suit, and if I buy a liverwurst sandwich, I throw most of it to the pigeons in Madison Park. I sit in that park and listen to men in white shirts and ties talking about their jobs, the stock market, the insurance business, and I wonder if they're content knowing this is what they'll be doing till their hair turns grey. They tell each other how they told off the boss, how he didn't have a word to say, his mouth going like this, you know, him stuck to his chair. They'll be bosses themselves someday with people telling them off, and how were they like that? There are days I'd give anything to be strolling along the banks of the Shannon, or out the Mulcair River, or even climbing the mountains behind Lengreese. One of the Blue Cross trainees passes me on his way back to the office. "Yo, McCourt, it's 2 o'clock, you coming?" He says yo because he drove a tank in a cavalry outfit in Korea, and that's how they talked when the cavalry had horses. He says yo because that tells the whole world he wasn't an ordinary infantry soldier. We walk to the insurance building, and I know I can't go through that cathedral entrance. I know I'm not cut out for the world of insurance. "Yo, McCourt, come on, it's late. Puglia will have a shit fit." I'm not going in. "What?" "Not going in." I walk away down 4th Avenue. "Yo, McCourt, you crazy man, you're gonna be fired. Shit, man, I gotta go." I keep going in the bright July sun till I reach Union Square, where I sit and wonder, what have I done? They say, if you quit a job in any big firm or get fired, all the other firms are informed and doors are closed to you forever. Blue Cross is a big firm, and I might as well give up hope of ever having a big job in any big firm. But it's a good thing I quit now, rather than wait to have the lies on my application form discovered. Mr. Puglia told us that was such a serious offense, you'd not only be fired, but Blue Cross would demand repayment of the wages paid for the training session. And on top of that, your name is sent to all the other big firms, with a little red flag waving at the top of the page to warn them. "That little red flag," said Mr. Puglia, "means you're forever barred from the American corporate system, and you might as well move to Russia." Mr. Puglia loved talking like that, and I'm glad I'm away from him. leaving Union Square to stroll down Broadway with all the other New Yorkers who don't seem to have anything to do. It's easy to see that some have that little red flag on their names, men with beards and jewelry, and women with long hair and sandals, who would never be allowed inside the door of the American corporate system. There are New York places I'm seeing today for the first time. City Hall, the Brooklyn Bridge in the distance, a Protestant church, St. Paul's, which has the grave of Thomas Addis Emmett, brother of Robert, who was hanged for Ireland, and farther down Broadway, Trinity Church, looking the length of Wall Street. Down where the Staten Island ferries come and go, there's a bar, the Bean Pot, where I have the appetite for a whole liverwurst sandwich and a stein of beer because my tie is off and my jacket is over the back of a chair and I feel relieved I escaped with the little red flag on my name. There's something about finishing the liverwurst sandwich that tells me I've lost Emma forever. If she ever hears of my troubles with the American corporate system, she might shed a tear of pity for me. Though she'll be grateful in the long run, she settled for the insurance man from the Bronx. She'll be secure, knowing she is insured for everything, that she can't take a step that's not covered by insurance. It's a nickel for the Staten Island ferry, and the sight of the Statue of Liberty in Ellis Island reminds me of the morning in October 1949 I sailed into New York on the Irish Oak, past the city and up the river, to anchor that night in Poughkeepsie and on the next day to Albany, where I took the train back down to New York. That was nearly 4 years ago, and here I am on the Staten Island ferry with my tie stuffed in the pocket of the jacket hanging from my shoulder. Here I am without a job in the world, my girlfriend gone, and the little red flag waving on my name. I could go back to the Biltmore Hotel and take up where I left off, cleaning the lobby, scouring toilet bowls, laying carpet, but no, a man who was a corporal can never sink that low again. Looking at Ellis Island and an old wooden ferry rotting between two buildings makes me think of all the people who passed here before me, before my father and mother, all the people escaping the famine in Ireland, all the people from all over Europe landing here with their hearts in their mouths for fear they might be caught with diseases and sent back. And when you think of that, a great moaning moves across the water from Ellis Island, and you wonder if the people sent back had to return with their babies to places like Czechoslovakia and Hungary. People who were sent back like that were the saddest people in all of history. Worse than people like me, who might have bad eyes and the little red flag, but are still secure with the American passport. They won't let you stay on the ferry when it docks. You have to go inside, pay your nickel, and wait for the next ferry. And while I'm in there, I might as well have a beer at the terminal bar. I keep thinking about my mother and father sailing into this harbor over 25 years ago. And as I sail back and forth on the ferry 6 times, having a beer at each end, I keep thinking of the people with diseases who were sent back. That makes me so sad. I leave the ferry altogether to call Tom Clifford at Port Warehouses and ask him to meet me at the Bean Pot, so that I'll know how to get home to the small apartment in Queens. He meets me at the Bean Pot, and when I tell him the liverwurst sandwiches here are delicious, he says he's finished with liverwurst. He's moving on. Then he laughs and tells me I must have had a few, that I'm having trouble getting my tongue around the word liverwurst, and I tell him no. It's the day I've had with Pugli and the Blue Cross and the airless room and the little red flag and the ones who were sent back, the saddest of all. He doesn't know what I'm talking about. He tells me my eyes are crossing in my head. Put on my jacket, home to Queens, and into bed. Mr. Campbell Grohl takes me back at Port Warehouses, and I'm glad to be getting decent wages again. $75 a week, going up to $77 for operating the forklift truck 2 days a week. Regular platform work means you're on your feet in the truck, loading pallets with boxes, crates, sacks of fruit and peppers. Working the forklift is easier. You hoist up the loaded pallets, store them inside, and wait for the next load. No one minds if you read the paper while you wait. But if you read the New York Times, they laugh and say, "Oh, look at the big intellectual on the forklift." One of my jobs is to store bags of hot peppers off United Fruit ships in the fumigation room. On a slow day, it's a good place to bring in a beer, read the paper, take a nap. No one seems to mind. Even Mr. Campbell Grohl on his way out of the office might look in and smile. Take it easy, men. It's a hot day. Horace, the black man, sits on a bag of peppers and reads the paper from Jamaica, or he reads a letter over and over from his son who's in a university in Canada. When he reads that letter, he slaps his thigh and laughs. Oh, man, oh, man. The first time I ever heard him talk, his accent sounded so Irish, I asked him if he was from County Cork, and he couldn't stop laughing. He said, all people from the islands have Irish blood, man. Horace and I nearly died together in that fumigation room. The beer and the heat made us so drowsy, we fell asleep on the floor, till we heard the door slam shut and the gas hissing into the room. We tried to push the door back, but it was jammed, and the gas was making us sick, till Horace climbed up on a mound of pepper sacks, broke a window and called for help. Eddie Lynch was closing up outside, and he heard us and slid the door back. "You're two lucky bastards," he said, and he wanted to take us up the street for a few beers to clear our lungs and to celebrate. Horace says, "No, man, I can't go to that bar." "What the hell are you talking about?" says Eddie. "Black man not welcome in that bar." "Fuck that for a story," says Eddie. "No, man, no trouble. There's another place we have a beer, man." I don't know why Horace has to give in like that. He has a son in a university in Canada, and he can't have a beer himself in a New York bar. He tells me I don't understand, that I'm young, and I can't fight the black man's fight. Eddie says, "Yeah, you're right, Horace." In a few weeks, Mr. Campbell Grohl says the port of New York is not what it used to be. Business is slow. He has to lay off a few men. And of course, I'm the junior man, first to go. A few blocks away is Merchants Refrigerating Company, and they need a platform man to fill in for men on summer vacation. They tell me, "We might be having a heat wave, but dress warm." My job is unloading meat from freezer trucks that bring sides of beef from Chicago. It's August on the platform, but inside where we hang the meat, it's freezing. The men laugh and say we're the only workers who travel so fast from the North Pole to the equator and back. Peter McNamee is platform boss, while the regular man is on vacation. And when he sees me, he says, "What in the name of the crucified Jesus are you doing here? Thought you had a brain in your head." He tells me I should be going to school, that there's no excuse for me humping sides of beef in and out, when I could be using the GI Bill and moving up in the world. He says, "This is no job for the Irish. They come here, and the next thing they're hacking and coughing up blood, discovering they had TB all along, the curse of the Irish race, but the last generation to be afflicted." It's Peter's job to report if anyone is hacking or coughing all over the sides of beef. Board of Health inspectors would close the place down in a minute, and we'd be on the streets scratching our arses looking for work. Peter tells me he's weary of the whole game himself. He couldn't get along with the cousin in Long Island. Now he's back in another boarding house in the Bronx, and it's the same old game. Bring home the side of beef or any kind of meat on a Friday night, and he gets the free lodging. His mother torments him with her letters. Why can't he find a nice girl and settle down and give her a grandson? Or is he waiting for her to sink into the grave? She nags him so much about finding a wife, he doesn't want to read her letters anymore. My second Friday at Merchants Refrigerating, Peter wraps up the side of beef in newspaper and asks me if I'd like a drink up the street. He rests the side of beef on a bar stool, but the meat begins to defrost and there are blood spots, and that upsets the bartender. He tells Peter he can't have that kind of thing in the bar, and he better put it somewhere. Peter says, "All right, all right." And when the bartender isn't looking, he takes the side of beef into the men's lavatory and leaves it there. He returns to the bar. When he starts talking about the way his mother nags him, he shifts from beer to whiskey. The bartender sympathizes with him because they're both from the county cavern, and they tell me I wouldn't understand. There's a sudden roar from the men's lavatory and a big man stumbles out yelling that there's a huge rat sitting on the toilet seat. The bartender barks at Peter, "Damn it the hell, McNamee, is that where you put the goddamn meat? Get it out of this bar." Peter retrieves his meat. "Come on, McCourt, that's the end of it. I'm worn out dragging the meat around on Friday nights. I'm going to a dance to get a wife." We take a taxi to the Jaeger house, but they won't let Peter in with the meat. He offers to leave it at the coat check, but they won't accept it. He creates a disturbance, and when the manager says, "Come on, come on, get that meat out of here," Peter swings at him with the side of beef. The manager calls for help, and Peter and I are pushed down the stairs by two big men from Kerry. Peter yells that he's only looking for a wife and they should be ashamed of themselves. The Kerry men laugh and tell him he's an arsehole, and if he doesn't behave himself, they'll wrap that meat around his head. Peter stands still in the middle of the sidewalk and gives the Kerryman a peculiar, sober look. "You're right," he says, and offers them the meat. They won't take it. He offers it to people passing by, but they shake their heads and hurry past him. "I don't know what to do with this meat," he says. "Half the world is starving, but no one wants my meat." We go to Wright's restaurant in East 86th Street, and Peter asks if they give us two dinners in exchange for a side of beef. "No, they can't do that. Board of Health regulations." He runs to the middle of the street, lays the meat on the center line, runs back, and laughs at the way the cars swerve to avoid the meat. Laughs even more when there's the sound of sirens and a police car and an ambulance scream around the corner and stop with flashing lights and men stand around the meat scratching their heads and then laughing till they drive away with the meat in the back of the police car. He seems to be sober now, and we order eggs and bacon at Wright's. "It's Friday," says Peter, "but I don't give a shit. That's the last time I'll drag meat through the streets and subways of New York. I'm tired of being Irish anyway. I'd like to wake up in the morning and be nothing, or some kind of American Protestant. So will you pay for my eggs? Because I have to save my money and go to Vermont and be nothing." And he walks out the door. Chapter 23. On a slow day at Merchant's Refrigerating, we're told we can go home. Instead of taking the train back to Queens, I walk up Hudson Street and stop at a bar called the White Horse. I'm nearly 23, but I have to prove I'm 18 before they'll give me a beer and an awkward sandwich. It's quiet in the bar, even though I read in the paper it's a favorite place of poets, especially the wild man, Dylan Thomas. People sitting at tables by the windows look like poets and artists, and they're probably wondering why I'm sitting at the bar with trousers caked with beef blood. I wish I could sit there by the windows with a long-haired girl and tell her how I've read Dostoevsky and how Herman Melville got me thrown out of the hospital in Munich. There's nothing to do but sit at the bar tormenting myself with questions. What am I doing here with this Knockwurst and beer? What am I doing in the world at all? Will I spend the rest of my life hauling sides of beef from truck to freezer and vice versa? Will I end my days in a small apartment in Queens while Emma is happy raising a family in a suburb completely protected by insurance? Will I ride the subways all my life, envying people carrying books from universities? I shouldn't be eating knockwurst at a time like this. I shouldn't be drinking beer when I don't have an answer in my head. I shouldn't be in this bar with poets and artists all sitting there with their serious whispered conversations. I'm weary of knockwurst and liverwurst and the feel of frozen meat on my shoulders every day. I push the knockwurst away and leave a half stein of beer and walk out the door across Hudson Street, along Bleecker Street, not knowing where I'm going, but knowing I have to keep walking till I know where I'm going. And here I am in Washington Square, and there's New York University, and I know that's where I have to go with my GI Bill. High school or no high school. A student points to the admissions office and the woman gives me an application. She says I didn't fill it in properly, that they need to know my high school graduation, where and when. I never went. You never went to high school? No, but I have the GI Bill, and I've been reading books all my life. Oh, my. But we require high school graduation, or the equivalency. But I read books, I've read Dostoevsky, and I've read Pierre or the Ambiguities. It's not as good as Moby Dick, but I read it in a hospital in Munich. You actually read Moby Dick? I did. And Pierre or the Ambiguities got me thrown out of the hospital in Munich. I can see she doesn't understand. She goes into another office with my application and brings out the dean of admissions, a woman with a kind face. The dean tells me I'm an unusual case and wants to know about my schooling in Ireland. It's her experience that European students are better prepared for college work, and she will allow me to enroll at NYU if I can maintain a B average for a year. She wants to know what kind of work I do, and when I tell her about the meet, she says, "My, my, I learn something every day." Since I'm not a high school graduate and work full-time, I'm allowed to take only two courses, Introduction to Literature and the History of Education in America. I don't know why I have to be introduced to literature, but the woman in the admissions office says it's a requirement, even though I've read Dostoevsky and Melville, and that's admirable for someone without a high school education. She says the History of Education course would provide me with the broad cultural background I need after my inadequate European education. I'm in heaven, and the first thing I do is buy the required textbooks, cover them with the purple and white NYU book jacket so that people in the subway will look at me admiringly. All I know of university classes is what I saw a long time ago in the movies in Limerick. And here I am, sitting in one, the History of American Education, with Professor Maxine Green up there on the platform telling us how the pilgrims educated their children. All around me are students scribbling away in their notebooks, and I wish I knew what to scribble myself. How am I supposed to know what's important out of all the things she's saying up there? Am I supposed to remember everything? Some students raise their hands to ask questions, but I could never do that. The whole class would stare at me and wonder, who's the one with the accent? I could try an American accent, but that never works. When I try it, people always smile and say, "Do I detect an Irish brogue?" The professor is saying, the pilgrims left England to escape religious persecution. And that puzzles me, because the pilgrims were English themselves. And the English were always the ones who persecuted everyone else, especially the Irish. I'd like to raise my hand and tell the professor how the Irish suffered for centuries under English rule. But I'm sure everyone in this class has a high school diploma, and if I open my mouth, they'll know I'm not one of them. Other students are easy about raising their hands, and they always say, "Well, I think..." Someday I'll raise my hand and say, "Well, I think..." But I don't know what to think about pilgrims and their education. Then the professor tells us ideas don't drop fully formed from the skies, that the pilgrims were, in the long run, children of the Reformation, with an accompanying worldview, and their attitudes towards children were so informed. There is more notebook scribbling around the room, the women busier than the men. The women scribble as if every word out of Professor Green's mouth was important. Then I wonder why I have this fat textbook on American education, which I carry in the subway so that people can admire me for being a college student. I know there will be examinations, a midterm and a final, but where will the questions come from? If the professor talks and talks, and the textbook is 700 pages, I'll surely be lost. There are good-looking girls in the class, and I'd like to ask one if she knows what I should know before the midterm exam in 7 weeks. I'd like to go to the university cafeteria or a Greenwich Village coffee shop and chat with the girl about the pilgrims and their Puritan ways and how they frightened the life out of their children. I could tell the girl how I read Dostoevsky and Melville, and she'd be impressed and fall in love with me, and we'd study the history of American education together. She'd make spaghetti, And we got to bed for the excitement, and then we'd sit up in the bed, reading the fat textbook, and wondering why people in all New England made themselves so miserable. Men in the class look at the scribbling women, and you know they're not paying the professor a scrap of attention. You know they're deciding which girls they'll talk to afterwards, and when this first class ends, they move towards the good-looking ones. They smile easily with their fine white teeth, and they're used to chatting because that's what they did in high school where boys and girls sit together. A good-looking girl will always have someone waiting for her in the hall outside, and the man in the class who started chatting with her will lose his smile. The lecturer in the Saturday morning class is Mr. Herbert. The girls in the class seem to like him, and they must know him from other classes, because they ask him about his honeymoon. He smiles and jingles the change in his trouser pocket and tells us about his honeymoon, and I wonder, what has this to do with introduction to literature? Then he asks us to write 200 words on an author we'd like to meet, and why? My author is Jonathan Swift, and I write that I'd like to meet him because of Gulliver's Travels. A man with an imagination like that would be a great one to have a cup of tea or a pint with. Mr. Herbert stands on his platform, looks through the S's and says, Frank McCourt? Where's Frank McCourt? I raise my hand and feel my face turning red. Ah, says Mr. Herbert, you like Jonathan Swift. I do. For his imagination? Huh? Yes. His smile is gone, and his voice doesn't sound friendly, and I feel uncomfortable with the way everyone in the class is looking at me. He says, you do know that Swift was a satirist, don't you? I have no notion of what he's talking about. I have to lie and say, I do. He says, you do know he was perhaps the greatest satirist in English literature. I thought he was Irish. Mr. Herbert looks at the class and smiles. Does that mean, Mr. McCourt, that if I'm from the Virgin Islands, I'm a virgin? There's laughter around the room, and I feel my face on fire. I know they're laughing at me because of the way Mr. Herbert toyed with me and put me in my place. Now he tells the class that my essay is a perfect example of a simplistic approach to literature, that while Gulliver's Travels may be enjoyed as a children's story, it is important in English literature, not Irish, ladies and gentlemen, for its satiric brilliance. He says, when we read great works of literature in college, we endeavor to rise above the mundane and the childish. And when he says that, he looks at me. The class ends, and the girls gather around Mr. Herbert to smile and tell him how they enjoyed his honeymoon story. And I feel so ashamed I walk down 6 flights of stairs so that I don't have to be in the elevator with students who might despise me for enjoying Gulliver's Travels for the wrong reasons, or even students who might feel sorry for me. I put my books in a bag, because I don't care anymore if people in the subway look at me admiringly. I can't hold on to a girl. I can't keep an office job. I make a fool of myself in my first literature class, and I wonder why I left Limerick at all. If I'd stayed there and taken the exam, I'd be a postman now, strolling from street to street, handing out letters, chatting with the women, going home for my tea without a worry in the world. I could have read Jonathan Swift to my heart's content, not giving a fiddler's fart whether he was a satirist or a shanaky. Chapter 24. Tom is in the apartment singing, making Irish stew, chatting with the wife of the landlord, the Greek downstairs with the dry cleaning shop. The landlord's wife is a thin blonde, and I can see she doesn't want me to be there. I walk through Woodside to the library to borrow a book I looked at the last time I was there. Sean O'Casey's I Knock at the Door. It's a book about growing up poor in Dublin, and I never knew you could write about things like that. It was all right for Charles Dickens to write about poor people in London, but his books always end with the characters discovering they're the long-lost sons of the Duke of Somerset, and everyone lives happily ever after. There's no happily ever after in Sean O'Casey. His eyes are worse than mine, so bad he could barely go to school. Still he manages to read, teaches himself to write, teaches himself Irish, writes plays for the Abbey Theatre, meets Lady Gregory and the poet Yeats, but has to leave Ireland when everyone turns against him. He'd never sit in a class and let someone mock him over Jonathan Swift. He'd fight back and then walk out, even if he walked into the wall with his bad eyes. He's the first Irish writer I ever read who writes about rags, dirt, hunger, babies dying. The other writers go on about farms and fairies and the mist that do beyond the bog, and it's a relief to discover one with bad eyes and a suffering mother. What I'm discovering now is that one thing leads to another. When Sean O'Casey writes about Lady Gregory or Yeats, I have to look them up in the Encyclopedia Britannica, and that keeps me busy till the librarian starts turning the light on and off. I don't know how I could have reached the age of 19 in Limerick, ignorant of all that went on in Dublin before my time. I have to go to the Encyclopedia Britannica to learn how famous the Irish writers were, Yeats, Lady Gregory, A.E., and John Millington Synge, who wrote plays where the people talk in a way I never heard in Limerick or anywhere else. Here I am in a library in Queens, discovering Irish literature, wondering why the schoolmaster never told us about these writers, till I discovered they were all Protestants, even Sean O'Casey, whose father came from Limerick. No one in Limerick would want to give Protestants credit for being great Irish writers. The second week of Introduction to Literature, Mr. Herbert says that from his personal point of view, one of the most desirable ingredients in a work of literature is gusto, and that is certainly found in the works of Jonathan Swift and his admirer, our friend Mr. McCourt. If there's a certain innocence in Mr. McCourt's apprehension of Swift, it is leavened with enthusiasm. Mr. Herbert tells the class, I was the only one of 33 people who selected a truly great writer. That it discourages him to think there are people in this class who consider Lloyd Douglas or Henry Morton Robinson great writers. Now he wants to know how and when I first read Swift, and I have to tell him how a blind man in Limerick paid me to read Swift to him when I was 12. I don't want to talk in class like this because of the shame last week, but I have to do what I'm told or I might be kicked out of the university. The other students are looking at me and whispering to each other, and I don't know whether they're sneering at me or admiring me. When the class ends, I take the stairs again instead of the elevator, but I can't get out the door at the bottom because of the sign that says fire exit and warns me if I push anything, there'll be alarms. I climb back to the sixth floor to take the elevator, but that door and the doors on the other floors are locked, and there's nothing to do but push the door on the ground floor till the alarm goes off, and I'm taken to an office to fill out a form and write a statement as to what I was doing in that place, causing alarms to go off. There's no use making a statement about my troubles with the teacher who mocked me the first week and praised me the second week, so I write that even though I dread elevators, I'll take them from this day out. I know this is what they want to hear, and I learned from the army it's easier to tell people in offices what they want to hear, because if you don't, there's always someone higher up who wants you to fill out a longer form. Chapter 25. Tom says he's tired of New York. He's going to Detroit, where he knows people, and he can make good money working on assembly lines and car factories. He tells me I should come with him, forget college. I won't get a degree for years, and even if I do, I won't make much money. If you're fast on the assembly line, you're promoted to foreman and supervisor, and before you know it, you're in an office telling people what to do, sitting there in your suit and tie with your secretary in a chair opposite, tossing her hair, crossing her legs, and asking if there's anything you'd like. Anything. Of course I'd like to go with Tom. I'd like to have money to drive around Detroit in a new car with a blonde beside me, a Protestant with no sense of sin. I could go back to Limerick in bright American clothes, except they'd want to know what kind of work I was doing in America, and I could never tell them I stood all day sticking bits and pieces into Buicks rolling past on the assembly line. I prefer to tell them I'm a student at New York University, even though some would say, university? How in God's name did you ever get into your university, you that left school at 13 and never set foot inside secondary school? They might say in Limerick I always had the makings of a swelled head, that I was too big for my boots, that I had a great notion of myself, that God put some of us here to hew wood and draw water, and who do I think I am anyway after my years in the lanes of Limerick? Horace, the black man I nearly died with in the fumigation chamber, tells me if I leave the university, I'm a fool. He works to keep his son in college in Canada, and that's the only way in America, man. His wife cleans offices on Broad Street, and she's happy because they've got a good boy up there in Canada, and they're saving a few dollars for his graduation day in 2 years. Their son Timothy wants to be a child doctor, so that he can go back to Jamaica to heal the sick children. Horace tells me I should thank God I'm white, a young white man with the GI Bill and good health. Maybe a little trouble there with the eyes, but still, better in this country to be white with bad eyes than black with good eyes. If his son ever told him he wanted to quit school to stand on an assembly line, sticking cigarette lighters into cars, he'd go up to Canada and break his head. There are men in the warehouse who laugh at me and want to know why the hell I sit there with Horace during lunch hour. What is there to talk about with a guy whose grandparents just fell out of a tree? If I sit off at the end of the platform reading a book for my classes, they ask if I'm some kind of a fairy, and they let their hands go limp at the wrists. I'd like to sink my bailing hook into their skulls, but Eddie Lynch tells them cut it out. Leave the kid alone. That they're ignorant slobs whose grandparents were still in the mud and wouldn't know a tree if it was rammed up their asses. The men won't answer Eddie, but they get back at me when we're unloading trucks by suddenly dropping boxes or crates so that my arms are jerked down and there's pain. If one is operating the forklift, he'll try to pin me to the wall and laugh. Whoops! Didn't see you there! After lunch, they might act friendly and ask how I enjoyed my sandwich. And if I say fine, they'll say, shit, man, didn't you taste the pigeon shit Joy sprayed on your ham? There are dark clouds in my head, and I want to go after Joy with my bailing hook. But the ham rises in my throat, and I'm throwing up off the platform with the men clutching each other and laughing. The only ones not laughing are Joy at the river end of the platform, looking at the sky, because everyone knows he's not right in the head, and Horace at the other end, watching and saying nothing. But after all the ham comes up and the retching stops, I know what Horace is thinking. He's thinking that if this were his son, Timothy, he'd tell him, walk away from this. And I know that's what I have to do. I walk to Eddie Lynch and pass him my bailing hook, making sure to offer him the handle to avoid the insult of the hook itself. He takes it and shakes hands with me. He says, okay, kid, good luck, and we'll send your paycheck. Eddie might be a platform boss with no education, who worked his way up, but he knows the situation. He knows what I'm thinking. I walk to Horace and shake hands with him. I can't say anything because I have a strange feeling of love for him that makes it hard to talk, and I wish he could be my father. He doesn't say anything either because he knows there are times like this when words have no meaning. He pats my shoulder and nods, and the last sound I hear at port warehouses is Eddie Lynch, get back to work, you bunch of limp pricks. On a Saturday morning, Tom and I ride the train to the bus station in Manhattan. He's on his way to Detroit, and I'm taking my army duffel bag to a boarding house in Washington Heights. Tom gets his ticket, stows his bags in the luggage compartment, steps up on the bus and says, you sure? Are you sure you don't want to come to Detroit? You could have a hell of a life. I could easily get on that bus. Everything I own is in that duffel bag, and I could throw it in there with Tom's bags, get a ticket, and be on my way to a great adventure with money and blondes and secretaries offering me everything, anything. But I think of Horace telling me what a fool I'd be, and I know he's right, and I shake my head at Tom before the bus door closes and he makes his way to his seat, smiling and waving. All the way up to Washington Heights on the A train, I'm caught between Tom and Horace, Detroit, and New York University. Why couldn't I just get a job in a factory, 8 to 5, an hour for lunch, 2 weeks vacation every year? I could go home in the evening, take a shower, go out with a girl, read a book when I felt like it. I wouldn't have to worry about professors mocking me 1 week, praising me the next. I wouldn't have to worry about papers and reading assignments from fat textbooks and exams. I'd be free. But if I traveled on trains and buses in Detroit, I might see students with their books, and I'd wonder what kind of fool I was to give up New York University for the sake of making money on the assembly line. I know I'd never be content without a college degree, and always wondering what I missed. Every day I'm learning how ignorant I am, especially when I go for a coffee and a grilled cheese sandwich in the cafeteria at NYU. There are always crowds of students who drop their books on the floor, seem to have nothing to do but talk about their courses. They complain about professors and curse them for giving low grades. They brag about how they use the same term paper for more than one course, or they laugh over the ways you can fool a professor with papers copied directly from encyclopedias or paraphrased from books. Most of the classes are so big, the professors can only skim the papers, and if they have assistants, they don't know from shit. That's what the students say, and going to college seems to be a great game with them. Everyone talks and no one listens, and I can see why. I'd like to be an ordinary student talking and complaining, but I wouldn't be able to listen to people talking about something called the grade average. They talk about the average because that's what gets you into good graduate schools, and that's what the parents fret over. When they're not talking about their averages, the students argue about the meaning of everything, life, the existence of God, the terrible state of the world, and you never know when someone is going to drop in the one word that gives everyone the deep, serious look. Existentialism. They might talk about how they want to be doctors and lawyers till one throws up his hands and declares everything is meaningless, that the only person in the world who makes any sense is Albert Camus, who says your most important act every day is deciding not to commit suicide. If ever I'm to sit with a group like this with my books on the floor and turn gloomy over how empty everything is, I'll have to look up existentialism and find out who Albert Camus is. That's what I intend to do till the students start talking about the different colleges, and I discover I'm in the one that everyone looks down on, the School of Education. It's good to be in the business school or the Washington Square College of Arts and Sciences, but if you're in the School of Ed, you're at the bottom of the scale. You're going to be a teacher. And who wants to be a teacher? Some of the students' mothers are teachers, and they don't get paid shit, man, shit. You break your ass for a bunch of kids who don't appreciate you, and what do you get? Bupkis, that's what you get. I know from the way they say it that bupkis isn't good, and that's another word I have to look up along with existentialism. It gives me a dark feeling sitting there in the cafeteria, listening to all the bright talk around me, knowing I'll never catch up with the other students. There they are with their high school diplomas and their parents working away to send them to NYU to be doctors and lawyers. But do their parents know how much time their sons and daughters spend in the cafeteria going on about existentialism and suicide? Here I am, 23, with no high school diploma, bad eyes, bad teeth, bad everything. And what am I doing here at all? I feel lucky I didn't try to sit with the clever, suicidal students. If they ever found out I wanted to be a teacher, I'd be the laughingstock of the group. I should probably sit in some other part of the cafeteria with future teachers from the School of Education. But that would show the world I'm with the losers who couldn't get into the good colleges. The only thing to do is finish my coffee and grilled cheese sandwich and go to the library to look up existentialism and find out what makes Camus so sad, just in case.